Thank you very much. I'm very impressed to have this number of people up early and actually willing to even listen to a party chairman. It wouldn't be everyone's first choice of companions for breakfast, but I admire your fortitude and your willingness to hear what I have to say. I have been chairman of the Idaho Republican Party for almost 2 years, but sort of like what everyone would say in Washington, life is better outside the Beltway. I don't want to demonstrate any disrespect to the people who live around Boise. There's actually an important political point I'd like to make about the future of the Republican Party that has to do with the population in this area. But there seemed to have been some kind of a secret plan going on here in Idaho where we had somewhat of a Hatfield and McCoy situation, and there seemed to be an interest in burning the whole house down, and after they succeeded in doing that, the only person who could come in and try to help the rebuild was a Martian from another planet. So here is your Martian with you for breakfast. How many times have you thought of someone entering Idaho politics by way of speaking Mandarin Chinese, having worked for an intelligence agency, having worked in the White House, lived around the world, and spent time on national media? Don't exactly have dirt under my cowboy boots, and a number of other kind of ties that would naturally try say this person is of Idaho, represents Idaho, and so I make no pretense about that. I have deep respect for the state that I have chosen to live in, but I'm always mindful that there are people who have deep roots and are deeply committed to what it means to be an Idahoan and what makes this state attractive to those of us who value being here. Some of the places I've gone around Idaho, I'll hear people kind of whisper, say, you know, don't let people from California know what we have going on in this particular part of the state, because what makes it great is we don't have so many people from the outside coming in. When I moved into Idaho Falls, one of the larger businessmen in the area, we were talking about what some national commercial strategies had been to try to attract foreign investment in the United States. And he said, well, you know, a lot of that might apply in this area, but I don't know that I really want to invite that many more people to come in and set up shop. He felt kind of comfortable in the position he was in. So there's been an interesting mentality that way, and I've always been mindful that I have sometimes a little bit of a different accent. Sometimes I might speak a little faster than the next person behind me. But sort of the way my family came together, my coming to Idaho fits into that pattern. So I'll give a little bit of a biography. I hope it doesn't come across as odd or braggy, but it has to do with how I think, and it has to do with how I think about the topic that I was asked to address this morning. I come from an extremely large family that was a combination of two lines of immigrants to the United States. One came from England, the other was a blend of kind of the United Nations of Europe. But one came across Canada, dropped down through Wisconsin, homesteaded in Nebraska, and then courtesy of the Great Depression, went off to war in the Pacific under the GI Bill, got a degree, and then went to work in the Department of Interior in Washington, D.C. as a signals engineer, doing rural electrification and other kinds of things, because after living through the Great Depression and the Great War, my granddad thought that the only sensible thing anyone should do is to get a government job so he could at least plan for retirement and methodically planned out the rest of his life. He was a Marine. He ran the Marine Corps Marathon every year until he was blind. And then he walked in the Senior Olympics and did some other kinds of things. That was one line of my family. Extremely methodical engineering agriculture guys that I was born a hayseed from Nebraska and felt out of place the rest of my life. The other side of my family came from England. Great-grandfather went to Reading, Pennsylvania, lied on his job application, said he was an accountant, but was smart enough to pull off getting the job, moved into Sandy Springs near Washington, D.C. He invested in this small upstart known as Standard Oil, and he did okay holding on to that through the market crash and the rebuild afterwards. Problem for me is he had six kids of his own, each of them having plenty of kids, including my grandfather, who had 15 children. My father was the fourth of 15, and my granddad seemed to want to self-populate the St. Peter's Parish in Olney, Maryland, and so half of the congregation, basically, in Olney was Yates. So we were kind of liked and hated in a certain sense because there's so many of these crazy Yateses running around. My granddad was a country doctor. One thing that country doctors do is read people, have a sense of what's going on in their lives. Occasionally, they'll exchange fried chicken and a pie for delivering a baby or checking out somebody that's sick. Something that's a little harder to do in this day and age of medicine and healthcare, but it's kind of the environment in which I grew up, the tail end of that era, where there was such a thing as a country doctor in the greater Washington, D.C. area. And he left a number of legacies with me. He was somewhat like my other grandfather. It might have been a trait of the generation that lived through those amazing events from nearly 100 years ago, where he was somewhat stern, believed that the kids growing up need to be pressed. If you asserted an opinion, he never stopped challenging you, whether it was perceived as nice, mean, inappropriate, or appropriate. It's kind of what he did. But we had this dialectical relationship all the way through my graduate school where he was challenging what I thought, and it helped me kind of think more about people. But it always came down to what is actually driving the people that you're interacting with. How are you actually trying to help them? And every member of our family in some form or fashion is a systems person, whether they're trying to assess and improve the systems of the human body or a computer program or running a farm. I had an uncle that ran a dairy farm for a number of years. Every one of us kind of has a compulsion for looking at systems and how they need to improve and how they need to work. Okay, that ties back into the Republican Party, something that wasn't working, and something that I had lived most of my life believing in. I grew up at a time when people today talk about how bad things are, and there are a couple of meridians in my life that remind me of things aren't anywhere near as bad as they've been, even just in my brief lifetime. But when I was a kid, there was television coverage of the nation's capital actually on fire. There was coverage of a president resigning from the White House. I had uncles who fought in the Vietnam War and uncles who went to jail protesting the Vietnam War. And we lived in this large family, and we had to come up with a lot of creative things to try to get by. We had things like oil shocks that would come along, and people had some economic hardships. And as rough as things have been in recent years, and they have been rough for people, it's not like what it was in those shocks that happened in the early 70s and in the late 70s. And, you know, I don't know if how many of you can remember people actually waiting in long lines in order to fill up their gas tanks. And thankfully, as hard as things have been, we haven't been back at that. Now, we had large gatherings until my grandparents passed away and the generations started to fray. And when we would get together, we would be loud sometimes and argumentative, and that was sort of kind of fed by our patriarch. But we learned, and when all was said and done, we loved. No matter what happened in our family, if you had something wrong with your plumbing, there was a plumber in the family, whether by trade or just because he was the guy that was stuck with that growing up because someone in the household had to do this stuff. If you had a problem with your car, there were mechanics. You felt a little sick, you'd go see granddad and he'd tell you, toughen up, take two aspirin and get out of here. My father had a stick stuck in his ear and it popped one of his eardrums, and my grandfather just sort of, yeah, go on, you know, you'll be fine. He wasn't, but that's kind of the medicine we had. And actually, for a lot of people, that does kind of work. We're tough and we recover and we move forward. Well, when I was working in the White House and there was this small controversial issue known as the Iraq War going on, I don't know if any of you noticed that, but we'd have family gatherings and we'd have people that would be full-throated explaining how they were dismayed that a member of their family was working for Darth Vader or Satan or who knows whatever else, and they want to know, well, why this, why that? And I explained, well, I wasn't actually central to that decision. I sort of saw what things were coming along, and things always looked a little bit more complicated than they came across on the news. And we'd have a full-throated back and forth about it, but when we were done with that conversation, we were still cousins. We still loved each other. If there was something happening in his family, if his kids needed tending, they could stay at my house, and vice versa. We can't make politics into a family. Families are different. And we in the Republican Party, I believe, have a special identification with the value of families and family values. But we need to find a way to demonstrate that we believe and practice some of those things in how we conduct some elements of our public life. This is an ideal. Not all of us will aspire to it, and not each of us are the greatest examples of it at all times. But I believe that if you have some core values that hold you together, and that it's not necessarily about the person who's in charge or the person who is speaking, it's about the core values and objectives that you've agreed to advance. I don't remember being raised in my family being told that this is a declaration of our family. This is what we stand for as a family. These are the policy issues that we care about as a family. But that sense that there was something larger that held us together helped us overcome some of those divisions. And we can't convince everyone to abide by this kind of ethos, but we can help encourage a lot of people to abide by this kind of an ethos. So for me, I can't address the topic of the future of the Republican Party without addressing some of the things that we're trying to address in the present of the Republican Party. When we have things like hard-fought primaries, I fall back to those arguments about the Vietnam War, the Iraq War, or stagflation, or whatever else it was we were arguing about in my large family, most of which, unfortunately, were Democrats. Please forgive my partisanship. But we would have these knockdown, drag-out arguments, but we were okay coming out the other end. How do we, in a political organization or a community, come out the end of a competitive, tumultuous, gut-punching kind of primary and return to why are we Republicans and how do we hold together and how do we advance in some form or fashion what we believe in? That's where we are today. Of course, today we'll have votes tallied for the primaries across the state of Idaho. I am as anxious as anyone to just hurry up and get the results. It is not easy going through these political seasons. They seem longer every time we go through them. We have some interesting competitive races around the state in the Republican primary this time. We had certainly an interesting presidential primary. I don't know if any of you tuned into any of those debates. There seemed to be millions and millions of Americans who tuned in. That was the positive. The part that's a little bit more tricky is how people reacted to them. When you give 17 of the multiple flavors of Baskin and Robbins, people start to like one flavor over the others a lot. You do that for a whole year, and people's attachment to the person that they really liked is even deeper. And that parting brings such sweet sorrow when they drop. And it takes actually a part of the grieving process almost to go through, bury that campaign, and figure out how do we pick up and move on, much less begin to date the person who's left. And some people didn't want to ever date the person who's left. And that will be true in some of our state primaries. For all I know, it could be true with the current chairman of the Republican Party. It's definitely the case in terms of what we've gone through in the presidency. So, most simply, when someone asks me why am I Republican or what do Republicans believe in, there is a one-page document that I think answers it best. And it's the first page of the Republican Party platform. It's the preamble. And for me, it could be the beginning and the end of the core message that we send out. It lays out the things that we believe in, the value and importance of the family, the individual, treating other people with dignity, equal rights for all, talking about the value of free enterprise, talking about the ideals of limited government, having things decided closest to the people, all things which I think should be familiar to anyone in the room who's ever heard a Republican politico ever give a speech. But these are core values. What ends up muddying the waters, and the waters have to get muddied when we're choosing between particular candidates, is when we get out of the realm of what are the core values that hold us together, and then what are your policy solutions and prescriptions. And once you start doing that, I was taught in college that the word decide means to actually cut away. And so you're cutting away options. Once you start to do that, it hurts to cut. Some people are uncomfortable when you're cutting. And that's when we start getting more tension when we get into some of those specifics. But those core values about the roles of faith, family, freedom, sometimes firearms, fun things like that, Those are things that distinguish Republicans from all other political animals in Idaho and across the country. And when we come out of a tumultuous primary, we have to have at least a season where we're reminded of those things. So, where are we going as a party? I made some allusion to the fact that in 2014, we had some interesting events occur among Idaho Republicans. There was a primary that was hotly contested. There were divisions in the party. There were elements of the party that were active and vocal and pushing for one side or the other. We went to a convention that did not conclude its business, and the party ended up in court. And a judge declared that you are a party without leadership and you must hold an emergency meeting. That's when the alien was called in. And on August 2nd of 2014, that was an emergency meeting where I was elected. There literally was no place to go but up from there. So I'm guaranteed of not being compared unfavorably to where I came in. I think that we've made some reasonable progress trying to focus on those ideals, focus on fundamentals. I was never a world record performer in sports, but I did have beaten into my bald head that you have to do the fundamentals before you have the luxury of taking the winning shot. And if you're not going out there as a Republican and identifying voters and encouraging people to learn more about what our core beliefs are in our preamble and encouraging more unaffiliated voters who naturally are inclined toward those values to affiliate with the party, get people to engage their communities so that more people know what the Republican Party is about, and have meetings that people feel comfortable attending. I don't know how many of you are involved in marketing or trying to sell a product or getting people engaged in communities. It doesn't usually work well if your introduction is, how about I punch you in the gut and welcome you to join our club? Or how about I insult your family and your line of work or whatever else, but please understand that we are better than you. That's where you cross the line between righteousness and self-righteousness. And I don't think self-righteousness sells very well. And so we have got to have meetings that are inviting for people to join. We have got to talk more about the values that tie us together that are welcoming and enticing to more people to come and participate. We've worked very, very hard at that. Well, but then we come into a competitive presidential cycle. And when I look at what's happened in recent cycles, of course, I had somewhat of a privileged position to watch the 2000 and 2014 races. Those were, I think all of you will remember, some of the closest elections that we've had. I don't know how many of you remember the words hanging Chad. Anytime you need to know what that means is a bad election. It wasn't a clear, decisive victory. And in 2004, the whole world focused on Ohio because literally the entire election came down to a few precincts and counties in one state. That's a close election. That's not where we want to be when we're trying to decide as a nation of, are we going to turn left or are we going to turn right? And the answer is yes. And so we have, you know, what we hope for is kind of a clear mandate. So what are we going to have with presumptive nominee Donald Trump? I'm sure that all of you have an answer to that. Please share it with me at some point. The one thing that I am certain is going to happen, and it will be very attractive to a number of Republicans, but it gets somewhat away from the values in the building that I have as a priority here in Idaho, and that will be the challenge for us as an organization. But Donald Trump, I think, is guaranteed to just ferociously light up a torch and burn Hillary Clinton from here through the end of the election. And some of you may think that's fantastic, some of you may feel like that's horrifying, but I think that's the one thing that we know is going to happen going through the election cycle. And there are a lot of Republicans around the country that feel like too many of our nominees have pulled punches. Too many of our nominees have gone through, and we have a national media that's not exactly inclined towards our values and our party. And we have, in some ways, people who want to be gentlemanly and family-oriented the way I try to be in the way I talk. And sometimes the nice guy doesn't finish first. And so, if you have been thinking along those ways, 2016 is your year. It's not going to be like that. But we are going to have a lot of work to do to make sure that people understand what we're doing and why we organize within our states, how we continue to engage our communities. There's going to be this ferocious competition in the media that's just going to be kind of a slobber knocker, and the rest of us are going to have to be working on down ticket races. Hopefully it comes across, I'm not saying that the person who's winning our nomination isn't the person that's called for the times. I believe in market forces. I believe that in the importance of a majority vote in a process, and that part of being an officer in a party is that you help run a fair process, the voters vote, and you live with those outcomes, and if you don't like it, you work within the process to try to rally more people so that your majority wins the next time. But you don't spend the time after the primary through the general election bickering over my guy was better than the other guy. You basically need to try to carry the brand through that cycle, and you live to fight another day for your version of where the party should be going. So, when it comes to where are Idaho Republicans going, we're going to have a key litmus test of that in our convention coming up in a couple of weeks in Nampa, June 2nd through 4th. We're going to organize a number of events that focus people on those fundamentals that I believe we have to do well before we have the luxury of people thinking that our organization has value and that our nomination has particular value and that the values we put into our platform have value. So we've got to work on those fundamentals. We're going to have people come and talk about the need for civility in politics and better Republican messaging. I can take that medicine. We need to have better Republican messaging. So we're going to have very successful people come in from the outside and talk to us about how to think about that differently. We're going to have Wall Street Journal columnist Kim Strassel come in and preview a book that she's got coming out later in June about how liberals are stifling the First Amendment rights of conservatives. I actually believe that happens. I've lived with some of that. But you know what? Occasionally conservatives try to stifle the First Amendment rights of others, and I feel like you can't actually proclaim that you support the values in the Bill of Rights for yourself if you don't equally defend those rights for the people you disagree with. So First Amendment rights, association rights, and things like that, your true measure of integrity is whether you will protect those things for people you disagree with. And as conservatives, we have to be careful to make sure we're doing that too along the way. I have a good friend who's a radio host for the Blaze Network, Buck Sexton, a younger guy who's worked in the intelligence world but also talks about a whole host of other issues. And he's going to come in and give a rousing rendition of a Never Hillary speech, which is basically, at this point, what national Republicans can agree on. And so we're gonna have some firearms events so that people have sort of a joke that I say, you know, look, rights are sort of like our bodies. If we don't exercise them, those rights get a little bit loosey-goosey, and so we need to practice these rights if we're going to be healthy and strong and ready to exercise those rights. I encourage people to exercise their First Amendment rights just as much. Where we go as a nation politically, obviously I hope that the Republican nominee wins the White House this cycle. I feel like the stakes for our nation couldn't be greater. The balance of the Supreme Court, perhaps for a generation, lies in the breach. Whether the nominee is my first or tenth choice for the nominee for our party matters not at all. I have an absolute certainty that I know the kinds of nominees that Hillary Clinton would put forward, and they trouble me more than the uncertainty that our nominee might bring to the table, at least in my calculation. I also believe that it's vital that we work hard to support and influence those who are in the Republican majorities in the House and Senate in D.C. It is not a satisfying message to bring, but is nonetheless a constitutional one, that no matter what your frustrations may have been, and mine have been there too, about going through cycles where we give Republicans majorities in the House and then in the Senate, and yet things don't seem to go where we want them to go, the Constitution gives unequal influence in some ways to the office of the presidency. And in many ways, the executive branch has an advantage over the legislative branch. And it's only when we have an alignment across those agencies and across Pennsylvania Avenue between the White House and the Congress that we can really even get progress moving in the right direction. And our founders made it frustrating and incremental. So I think that we have a vital mission to push things in that direction. But the outcome of this election is going to basically set a course. Either we've gone through a very, very disruptive 2016 cycle would totally cleanse the palate on what kind of Republican candidates are coming forward. And for all I know, Bernie Sanders is cleansing the Democratic palate on the kinds of traditional candidates that are going to come forward. And we'll have a different new normal for the major parties going forward. Or we're going to basically go through, struggle through this campaign. Hillary Clinton is president. The Supreme Court balance changes. Bill Clinton is back in the White House. And who knows, you know, if you thought you were done with salacious coverage of politics, there were back in the 1990s from my point of view. I don't believe that's our future. And I think that what we're doing at the state level and in the community level is more important. I hope that we as a party do a better job of engaging communities. I hope that we as a party make more clear that we stand with people who are in agriculture. We stand with people who are in private enterprise. We stand with our first responders. We stand with our veterans and our active duty military. We stand with those who sacrifice to protect the freedoms that we have, to exercise the rights that we celebrate, and that we're actually out there embracing the communities that we're active in. Being a part of a party shouldn't be coming to a monthly meeting and declaring how the rest of the world should run itself. Being part of a party means you should come to a monthly meeting and sharing, this is the community we live in. These are the values that we are trying to promote. These are the values that we see that are at risk. And this is what our plan is, to go out there and engage and try to promote the things that we believe in and get more people to affiliate. That's, I think, probably a fair amount of overview. I don't want to practice the Senate filibuster and either put you to sleep, which is a natural thing to do in the morning, but with all due respect to anyone who might be involved in morning radio, I know Nate has a more humane life cycle, and it was actually inhumane to have him get up in the morning and have to do an intro, but I'm grateful that he did it. But I'd like to just turn time over for questions and answers and let you be a part of guiding the conversation from here, so I'm using your time well.
Tell us your reaction to the difference between the North and the South in Idaho.
Uh-huh. Well, being that alien from another planet, my orientation to Idaho politics did not fall into this division of North-South. It came into the three-part theory of different Idaho realities. First, I don't know if any of you watched this program. It was on one of the educational networks about how the boundaries of states were drawn. And Idaho was described in this program as the state that was left after all the other boundaries were drawn. But it says something culturally about what we are as a state and politically as a state. North Idaho, the greater Boise area, and southeastern Idaho are distinct in several ways, culturally, economically, theologically, the history of who came to Idaho, and the industries around which they organized are distinct. And this is one of the things that I was alluding to earlier that's changing a lot. Each of these three areas are changing a great deal. North Idaho, of course, all of you know, is a part of a separate media market predominantly that doesn't belong to the state of Idaho. There's an awful lot of activity in North Idaho that's organized around Spokane, which last I checked is outside of our boundaries. There are profound migration flows that are going into North Idaho, where we have a lot of people who have worked in the civil service in the state of California or a military or some other entity, and they've retired to North Idaho. It brings a degree of wealth in because these are people on steady income. They're increasing the cost of housing. There are some pluses, there's some minuses, but what it's definitely done is change the culture a little bit. And my first impression of getting up there and getting a sense of where things are going is when you find people who've lived with 40 years of frustration in an overly liberal area, and they then move to Idaho, into North Idaho, and all of a sudden that unbounded expression of here's the conservatism I've wanted to shout from the rooftops for 40 years, and finally, I can go ahead and do it. You've got a full-throated activism that is too loud and too proud, say, for a more understated southeastern Idaho. But it's in full bloom in North Idaho in a lot of what we do. And For some of us who lived in truly liberal areas, it's shocking to hear some of the discourse about what I see as of this part of the spectrum on the right, and people trying to say that the people on the left end of the spectrum are liberals, because I see an entire spectrum that is almost completely on the center right. And if you've lived in these other environments, much less as I did early in my life, live in a country that had come out of martial law, and there was all kinds of statism between party and state. There wasn't anything like a free market where I was living. And you come back to the United States, you know, what we have in Idaho is the closest thing to nirvana to a lot of what some of us see. But there's still kind of these sharp lines drawn, an absolute war going on one end of the spectrum. That's what I see in North Idaho. What I see in the greater Boise area is a profound demographic change that is going to have a major impact on the future of the Republican Party and a major impact on the kinds of candidates that win statewide and congressional races. Before too long, the population within the Boise media market will influence the outcome of both of our congressional districts. And that a statewide candidate and a congressional candidate can plausibly win any of those positions without ever leaving the Boise media market. I wouldn't recommend that be the political strategy. It's bad for governance. But if you're just running a sheer numbers game in politics, the demographics are not far from being in that place. And the demographics of who's in what party. We've done, I think, successful work in getting more registered Republican numbers going up statewide. The gap in recent cycles has been closing between registered Democrats and registered Republicans. With our early presidential primary, though, we were able to add 60,000 new affiliated Republicans. And for the first time in history, registered Republicans outnumber unaffiliateds. And so we've been able to make some progress. But we can't sit on that because of the demographic change I just alluded to. Southeastern Idaho, just different culture, much more dominant impact of the realities of agriculture industries, and the pioneer heritage and other kinds of things leads to a little bit higher premium on being understated in politics. And we'll see in the outcome of our primary races whether majority voters go for people who are more bold and what some people might call firebrands in their expression of politics, or the more low-key, this is a multi-generation person from an established family who shares a lot of these core values, but turns down the volume a little bit. I'm fascinated to see where the voters go on things like that, but those are the differences that I've seen.
I appreciate what a good speaker you are, and I appreciate your respect for the First Amendment. And so saying that, it breaks my heart to ask these two questions. The first question is Larry Craig really a finance chair for the Idaho Republican Party? And the next question is, due to your high position on the National Security Council, have you ever heard the term SADM, S-A-D-M, Special Atomic Demolition Munition? Because that is what actually brought down the Twin Towers, because it was an inside job. But the Clintons were in on it too, Democrats, the top Democrats. You know, Hillary is her position as senator from New York on 9/11. So my first question is Larry Craig really a finance chair of Idaho? And do you know anything about the use of special atomic demolition munitions?
Yeah. Well, as you say, I respect your First Amendment right to ask both of those questions.
What was the question?
The first question was, is Larry Craig really the finance chair of the Idaho Republican Party? And the second one, forgive me for paraphrasing, but you can correct it after, was 9/11 really an inside job, is the way I understood the question. The quick answer to the first one is that Tom Luna is the finance chair of the Idaho Republican Party. But Larry Craig was the finance chair of the Idaho Republican Party. And I will tell you without any apology that Larry Craig made a tremendous contribution in terms of a voting record in Washington, D.C. Multiple decades of one of the most conservative voting records in the United States Congress. He also had multiple decades of personal relationships around this state. And for someone who, as I said, was a Martian coming into Idaho politics, I was not ignorant of someone making headlines. I myself in recent times have made headlines that I am not thrilled about. These things can happen. But I will never discard 4 decades of public service because of one controversy in terms of assessing an individual. And not everyone is going to agree with me on that, and I'm not asking everyone to agree with me on that. But understand this. The role of the finance chair of the Idaho Republican Party is to volunteer your time to go raise money over which you have zero control. And who's ready to sign up and go do that? And there weren't a long list of people ready, willing, and able to do that. My job was to try to rebuild, and Larry had relationships, deep relationships, with people that I needed to know and they needed to know me. And they didn't need to do it by way of the newspapers. It had to be personal ties. And I was working with other people who didn't have controversial things that had come up in the past. I am deeply grateful for his willingness to work privately with me and with people that were of consequence to try to get started really from scratch as we were trying to establish some sense of credibility in a wide range of relationships across Idaho politics. But he held that position for a little over a year, and Tom Luna is the current finance chair. But that's basically the answer to that question. I know it's not everyone's favorite answer or everyone's favorite topic, but I figure you are at least entitled to a candid and direct answer on that. On the 9/11 question being an inside job, I respect anyone's opinion, and with respect, I would suggest that is only an opinion. I'll tell you what my life was like and what I witnessed firsthand. I was in the Situation Room on September 10th. We had a deputies committee meeting on Afghanistan. There was a question about an assassination of a guy named Massoud. And what did that mean for the future of Afghanistan? I was in the room when the number twos of the major cabinet agencies on national security and in the White House were trying to talk about what's happening in Afghanistan, what's going on with this network known as Al-Qaeda. And we had all kinds of threat information that said an attack is imminent and that they were organizing and were going to strike, but there was never anything quite as helpful as saying maybe where or how. And even if we had known, if they'd said they're going to attack the air system of the United States, so they're going to, the threat is going to be carried out by way of hijacking. Even if we had known that, and I can test to you that none of the intelligence that came into the United States said that they were going to attack by way of hijacking on roughly this date and in this geography. And in fact, hijacking was just one of many ways. Would the United States, even under current times, when we are trying to balance security versus liberty and commerce, would we have supported halting all air travel for one day, for one week, for one month, while we waited to see whether this was carried out in this manner or some other manner? The next morning I got up, it was a crisp, clear morning in Washington. I was preparing the vice president to go to the Congress to meet with an official from Hong Kong and for John Howard of Australia to give a joint address to Congress. And when I was walking back across West Executive Avenue to my office after preparing the vice president to move up to Capitol Hill soon, one of our military aides said, "Sir, you have to look at this news coverage." And we saw what was on TV with the fires in the towers, well, the first fire. And I thought, well, how horrible. That's one of the creepier scenarios I'd always worried about when I'd see those tall buildings is what happens when you have a fire that's nearly 100 floors in the air. And they were trying to explain that an airplane had hit and people had seen it. There was supposedly some coverage of it. And I said, how in the world does an airplane hit a tower in Manhattan? How does it ever even get that close? We have some protocols in place to intercept airplanes to keep them away, but they hadn't been used in recent times, and So how in the world does it happen? What are you talking about? Some Cessna that had gone astray? And while we're talking, the other plane goes through. I could tell you more of the day. And that's where I learned that humans in a crisis really don't understand English. They only understand a loud voice and a shove. Because people will walk out as alarms are going off saying, where are we supposed to go? And very large men with very large ordnance and gray uniforms are basically just repeating one word over and over until you acknowledge that you understand English. And it was evacuate. And you'd say, which way? Evacuate. You say, I don't know where my group's supposed to go. Evacuate. And a hard push, and off you go. I spent much of that morning walking from the White House to the zoo. And many of you might not have any feel for what that distance was, but it's not an average walk in Washington. I spent most of that time trying to be able to let my family know that I was alive, because no one knew where these booms had hit. We'd seen smoke from across the Potomac River. We'd heard a boom that was near the State Department, turned out to be nothing, but we lived through this. I got up the next morning, went into the White House to resume work, and there was kind of a greasy spoon where I would get my sugar high in the morning to keep going through intelligence meetings and other enthralling work of government. And lo and behold, the person who was standing by that greasy spoon was a bloodshot, weary president of the United States who was personally thanking each member of staff who went to that greasy spoon breakfast joint for getting back up and coming back to work. You could see the weight of the world in the man. You could see his eyes well up somewhat with tears and tension and anxiety. This is a person who was not executing some kind of a plan. This was someone who was feeling the weight of the moment, the burden of responsibility, facing choices he did not want to have to face, facing uncertainties that made those choices extremely difficult, personally thanking no-name staff coming back in, who filed in out of a sense of duty. I saw him bend over the desk in the Oval Office and break down and cry a time or two over this. And, you know, people can kick all they want on this subject. I was there, I know, and I don't like the idea of people even trying to suggest that what I know is somehow completely invalid because there is a convenient narrative that you would rather believe. There is evil in this world. We don't get a vote on whether they like us or don't like us. The only decision we make is not whether we go to war. They get to decide whether they go to war with us. I hope that as I respect your right to answer the question, I hope that you respect my right to actually know what I lived and what I saw, and that theory is wrong.
Concerning the media, there was a survey done in 2010 that said that 85% of the media votes Democrat. In that same survey, it said it's better than 85% of the education system opposed media. This is basically where we get our information from the media and from education. Would you expound on that? And can we do something about that that makes it, you know, objectivity comes into play here? And I just don't think we're getting objective information, both in education and media.
Yeah. Fair enough. I've lived through some of those struggles too, and you know, my role in media has been to pretend like I know what I'm talking about, and some people will believe it's that I do, and some people are very certain that I don't. But there is kind of a system in which this can work, where you have contending views, and people kind of come and they make their cases and they duke it out, and where the chips fall, people have some sense of, well, maybe this is where the middle ground is, and I have at least something to base a decision on. You hear this sometimes in politics where people will say, well, you know, I've got this public policy question. I've had the best lobbyists for and the best lobbyists against who've come in and they've made their case, and I can sort of make a decision of where I think I want to fall for or against or splitting the difference. You know, there is no question that the people who own majority of broadcast media and print media tend to have more of a liberal bias. There also is no question that the majority of people who go through the schools of journalism tend to be mobilized by things that are more social issues that would tend to be more on the left side of the spectrum. I have met and have interacted with some people who take their craft extremely seriously, and they have a bias, but sort of like an attorney who feels the duty to kind of come in and take a case because the system only works if you do your job. And I've seen plenty of people who do that. But you today, what I see as the biggest problem, especially with print media, but in many others, is we have, most of our lives, seen people whose faces are in print, in pictures, or on broadcasts, whose voices come across the airwaves. We assume these people are stars, and in their own ways they are stars. But we then also assume that they're rolling in dough, that they're living the high life, they're a star, and all the things that we imagine that come with it. The fact of the matter is the media as an industry pays extremely poorly. And many of the bobbleheads on TV that sound like experts aren't getting paid anything. They are allowed to come on because there's something in their bio that says that you might want to hear what they have to say, but they're not making any money doing that. Then there are the people who do it for a job, and I guarantee that except for a blessed few, usually who have the combination of TV, radio, and some other audience that they've built up by way of a platform, except for that very few people, it's not an easy life. It is not one that you can actually make a great income doing. And so you end up with a disincentive for people to work really, really hard to try to be truly objective, because no one, it's sort of like no one ever really rewards you for reporting good news. Then, you know, no one ever sort of congratulates. You know, I think that was a really amazingly balanced piece. Sometimes that will happen, but usually we have people who care so much about issues that they're completely angry with you because you didn't attack these people who needed to be attacked, or you didn't tell all of the virtues of the people who needed to be defended, and this tension just sort of feeds what is an environment that's not totally satisfying. But we have, at the moment, in some ways, more options than have ever existed in human history for how to go get information. Our problem now is not that we don't have enough information, it's that we have maybe too much information, not that I want to shrink it, but not enough tools to help us with the discernment of how do we validate what we're getting. How do we apply it to something that has meaning in my life? But you know, I can go and Google any one of your companies or industries or affiliations and find a ton of information. But the difference between information and intelligence is applying, verifying, testing, things that, you know, we used to emphasize in the scientific method. That isn't happening between keyboard and publication in this day and age. And so we have to try to do it as consumers. And who has the time or inclination to do that enough? That to me is what I see as the challenge. It's almost like taking cooking ingredients and just throwing them out there, and it's your job to put them together right and cook the cookies. And we got a lot of unbaked cookies going out by way of news. All right. Let me go to the back here in front.
What confidence should I have that the situation in Washington and the House and the Senate has any chance of changing? There's no Brian Spriggins doesn't give me any confidence that anything out there is going to change. Mitch McConnell, or the new speaker.
Yeah, fair enough. This is not an unfamiliar topic, because you are far from alone in having the concerns or the skepticism. And some of them I may or may not have entertained myself. One thing that I would try to make a distinction of, just because I think it's only fair to the National Party Chairman, sort of like the State Party Chairman, I have no control over what the legislature does. I didn't elect them. The voters of the state of Idaho did. I have no control over what the constitutional officers do. If we have rapport, and if we're emphasizing those common values, and I've done something that adds value to their roles, hopefully that we can have a conversation, we can work together and move things in a common direction. But quite literally, every elected officer in the state of Idaho, outside of some precinct offices, was elected by more voters than I was. And I'm allegedly at the top of the food chain when it comes to what notion there is of elected office within the party structure in Idaho. I was elected in an emergency meeting where a total of just north of 200 people cast ballots. How many people is the governor elected by? How many people is your legislator elected by? The national party chairman faces that when it comes to Congress, the executive branch, governors, and things like that. Because guess how many people the national party chairman is elected by? There are 168 members of the Republican National Committee. They are the only people who vote for the national chairman. So he won a majority out of 168 votes. How much of a mandate is that to go in and tell a Speaker of the House, this is where the party is, this is where the country is, or to go to a nominee of a party? And so the short answer is, he can't. But he can talk about, this is what we're doing, these are the fundamentals we're developing, these are the households we interacted with, this is the data that we've been able to gather, we can tell you where voters are in key states, you have your data, we have ours, we can have a conversation. But in terms of mandate, party leaders only have influence to the extent that our volunteers and our workers are working and have accurate information and feedback to come back to our policymakers with. The separate issue, though, that I think is very, very challenging is whether anything will change in Washington and whether the congressional delegation can really do much. I think that our congressional delegation does a fairly good job of accurately representing the range of views in Idaho. I think that each in their own way punches above their weight when it comes to things happening in Washington. But two out of 435 members of the House of Representatives makes some difference. I think a difference that is greater than the number two out of 435. And two out of 100 senators, that's better odds. And I think that both of them punch above their weight, but it's really hard to move that stuff in the right direction. I, for now, if I was speaking on behalf of their reelection, I would say, please support them because they're pushing in the right direction, but it's a little bit like that analogy of holding a boulder from rolling back over us. And how much are they really going to be able to do to advance that boulder uphill? I do not place my faith in the future of the country in Washington, D.C. I do not place my faith in the future of the Republican Party in the National Party. I place my faith in the future of the country and the future of the party in what are we doing to engage our communities? What are we doing to build our brand here? I've had some people approach me and say, well, why in the world would I affiliate Republican when the party has produced a national nominee that I can't support? And I'd say, well, the Idaho Republican Party helped promote and the legislature funded and executed an early presidential primary, and a huge majority of Idaho registered Republicans participated in that. In fact, it was the single highest rate of voter participation in any primary in the history of Idaho primaries. And the voters spoke, and they chose Ted Cruz. He won Idaho. He didn't win the nomination. But what was wrong with what the Idaho Republican Party did in that process? We didn't tell people who they should pick. We organized as participatory and legitimate a process as could happen. A super majority of our membership participated, and the outcome is complicated. So my view is, it'll sound like a dodge, and it is to a degree, don't worry about the things we can't control, like Washington, but what do we do in this room, what do we do in this state, what do we do in our communities to control the things we can influence?